This is Writer's Cast, a podcast about books and authors. I'm your host, David Wilk. Today I'm talking to Lou Aronica. He's the author of a new novel called Blue, B-L-U-E. It's a really interesting novel that I think we'll have a good conversation about. Hey, Lou, how are you?
I'm fine, David. How are you?
Good. So, we'll talk a little bit about the background of the book. And as always with fiction, I try to avoid, giving away too much of the story. But, this is essentially a story about a young girl, I would say, early teenager, and her family. Her father and her mother are divorced, she becomes ill. What happens prior to the story is we learn that she had cancer and she was sick, but has gone into remission. And then she gets sick again. And maybe you could talk a little bit about, kind of the setup of the story and where it goes.
Basically, what happened when Becky, who is the girl who's 14 when the novel begins, when she was five, she got sick, and the course of the treatment was difficult for her, as you can imagine. Any 5-year-old would have enormous problem with that, and her father, in an attempt to just sort of make, she couldn't sleep, and in an attempt to sort of make it easier for her to get to sleep, he came up with the idea of they're telling a bedtime story together, creating a bedtime story together, and this became the world of Tamarisk, which is the fantasy world that they invented when she was little, and when she went into remission, their affection for this world had grown to the point where they continued to tell a story about Tamarisk every night for the next 5 years. But then when she was 10, Chris and Polly, the parents, divorced. And Becky was so upset about her father's inability to express his side of the story and why this had happened, that she decided that she would never tell another Tamarisk story.
Right, and she becomes kind of alienated from her father.
Yeah, well, what had the circumstances behind that was that the divorce was not of Chris's choosing. He knew that the marriage was bad, and he knew that it had been a long time since he felt any real passion for Polly, but his commitment to Becky was such that he never even considered the idea of giving up on the marriage. But his wife, who was feeling the same things, didn't feel the same way about hanging in there. And so Chris was so confused by that experience that he just didn't know how to explain it to his daughter. And her interpretation of that was that he didn't think she was capable of understanding it, and that made her very, very angry. And so she basically cut him off. I mean, they continue to see each other, a couple of times a week, but the huge connection that they had, much of it forged by this fantasy world that they created, goes away.
Right. The kind of thematic part of that is that he's incorrect in his assessment of what is the best way to relate to his daughter.
Yeah.
And maybe he is actually, as a character, unable, I mean, that's probably why he couldn't make the marriage work either. I mean, he does seem to have unstated issues that prevent him from being in a relationship successfully. Subsequently to getting divorced, he doesn't have a relationship. He's got a best friend who's a woman, and she sets him up with, myriad dates, which he can't do anything to promote. He does seem to have some problems.
Yeah, he's got some significant problems, and I think he's a person who allows life to happen to him, and that even manifests itself in his work life. He was a scientific background, and he was very happily involved in working in labs and that sort of thing. And he got kicked upstairs, and just sort of accepted that that was his fate, that he would no longer be able to do the things that he loved to do, that he was now just going to have to be an administrator. And he sort of continually allows life to just simply happen to him. And, you know, for somebody like Becky, who stared at the brink and fought it back, that's just not acceptable. And so this just continues. For 4 years, he basically just mopes, and she, you know, becomes this great, vibrant kid who doesn't get her dad and doesn't understand what happened between them, because there was such a magical relationship between them.
Right. And so, and again, we don't, you know, you've got to be careful about how much we talk about the story. But it is, you know, it suddenly happens that she learns that she's sick again. And I think that then changes everything, because, you know, the sensibility is that when the disease comes back, it's a pretty bad problem. You know, she admitted that she was having symptoms. So by the time they find out that she's really sick, it's, you know, they treat her, but it's pretty dire.
Yeah, she was basically, you know, she just kept believing that, you know, she could make it go away, and that obviously didn't happen. And so by the time, you know, she doesn't, I mean, she just keeps denying it until the point where she collapses, at which point it's, you know, rampant through her system.
Right. And here we have, you know, then the two parents who were estranged pretty significantly, you know, not getting along, and the mother, Polly, is remarried to a guy who seems pretty nice. And they have a good relationship, and she has a terrifically close relationship with Becky.
Mm-hmm.
But when the disease comes back, things shift. And, you know, you have this, you kind of now introduce Tamarisk as a place again, but in a different way. Instead of it just being stories that Chris tells, or that Chris and Becky make up together, Tamarisk comes to life. So we become now in a place where it's either science fiction or imaginative in some way. You know, we kind of enter another realm. The book goes from, you know, kind of real life to this other plane of existence. And, you know, do you feel like you've made, you know, at that point, like, people want to categorize, obviously, but, you know, are we in science fiction, or is this the realm of magical fiction in some way? How do you think about that?
Yeah, I sort of see it as a magic realist. And, you know, I think, you know, my affinity has always been toward that kind of fiction more than toward either science fiction or fantasy, because, you know, I think the thing that the magic realists always did was that they focused as much on their characters and on the relationships between the characters as they did on the tenets of the fantasy.
Right.
World.
So that the fantasy doesn't take you over. It's not about the as science fiction is about, although not all, but much science fiction is about the imagination of this other world, whereas magical realism is the imagination of this world but seen in a different way.
Right.
And, you know, of course, we don't know throughout the book. You never know, and the ambiguity, I think, is, you know, palpable and important. You don't know whether this is all taking place in Becky's imagination or whether it's real.
Right.
And you don't have to know. I mean, obviously, the reader can decide for her or himself whether they want to enter the fantasy and treat it as real, or consider it in some other way as a psychological underpinning. You know, there are all kinds of ways you can interpret it.
Right, and that was very intentional.
No, I can tell.
Yeah,
and, you know,
yeah.
I thought you handled that pretty well. You were careful to keep us from knowing what you thought.
That was an important piece of it for me, because I think there are so many different ways to interpret what's happening here, and I wanted, you know, the reader to be a participant in that. But, you know, essentially, you know, it's either a story about, you know, two people who care so much for each other that they join in an illusion together at a time of crisis, or it's a story about, you know, about two people, or about the power of imagination being so great that it actually manifests itself in a time of need.
Right, and it's also interesting because the world that she and Chris have created is both a product of their imaginations, but also then has a life of its own. So that it's sort of like imagining. I was thinking about this because I had just finished reading a book called The Child Thief,
mm-hmm.
Which is a reimagining of, and a really different version of the Peter Pan story melded with Avalon and really some, you know, a lot of other things. And I was thinking about that, you know, a lot of fiction that treats with the imagination and where it can take you leaves that question unanswered purposely. You know, even Peter Pan would be a good example. You can imagine there is this other place.
Mm-hmm.
Well, is it in the imagination of the teller or is it real? You want that suspension of disbelief to be possible. So,
yeah, and I thought it was critical in a story like this because, you know, ultimately this is, you know, no matter how you interpret it, this is a father-daughter story. And, you know, and I wanted everything that was set up around the novel to focus on the relationship between Chris and Becky. You know, even the creation of Maya, who's the third protagonist in this novel, and she's the queen in the fantasy world, is very much a manifestation of what Becky imagined herself being. You know, she created Maya, she told stories about Maya, and I wanted Maya to be a version of the grown-up Becky, you know, dealing with big issues, but dealing with them with great dignity and that sort of thing. And even that has multiple ways of being interpreted within the story, depending on how you interpret the events in the last quarter of the story.
Right, and also Maya, for that matter, she also is has this complicated history because her parents have been killed.
Right.
So she has to become this independent person and be in charge when she's not ready for it.
Yeah, she's entirely not ready for it, and fights it at the same time as she accepts the responsibility.
Right, which is sort of mirroring what's happening to Maya. I mean,
to Becky.
To Becky. Well, you know, it's sort of interesting obviously you're a father, you have daughters, so that resonates for you, and you know, I felt that you clearly you are someone who's paid attention to how teenagers operate because you've painted that pretty accurately, I think, and it will probably resonate. And I also should say, I think this book is, you know, clearly this is a book for adults, but also is a book for, you know, the kind of older teenager, you
mm-hmm.
know, what people have called categorically young adult. Which I think is a real misnomer and a bad categorization, but essentially readers of, you know, maybe the age group of the protagonists can read this book, but also I think you're talking as much more to the fathers than you are to the daughters.
I am, and I think, you know, it's impossible for me to write this. You know, it was impossible for me to write this without, you know, without looking at it from, you know, from an older perspective. But at the same time, I wanted Becky to be as real as I possibly could. And you're right; I've been paying a tremendous amount of attention to how teenage girls act for quite some time. And in fact, you know, the novel was inspired by, you know, for completely, you know, completely off from anything that's in the novel, but it was inspired by my concerns about my oldest child going to college. You know, when I started writing this novel 6 years ago, when my oldest daughter, to whom the novel is dedicated, was getting ready to go to college, and you know, and just concerns about, you know, losing her and losing touch with her and that sort of thing, and you know, obviously nobody cares about that kind of story, so I didn't want to write that story, but it sort of leapt from that to this to this much, you know, sort of more elaborate story. But
well, you know, I see fiction as performing a role. Now, this may be reductionist, I think, sometimes, but I think fiction performs a role for the creator, for the writer. Mm-hmm. Obviously, if it works successfully, it communicates to the reader as well. But in essence, you know, fiction is performing a kind of imaginative task for the writer.
Oh, absolutely. It's actually a fabulous form of therapy.
Yeah.
Not just in the writing process, but actually in the reviewing process. I remember, you know, when I published my first novel, or I delivered the manuscript for my first novel to my editor, there was a character, there was a relationship between a brother and sister in there that was, you know, fairly toxic, and my editor wondered about the motivation because it just wasn't wasn't as well laid out as it ultimately became. But she said to me, "Yeah, I just don't understand, why he hates her so much." And I thought, you know, that relationship was based on a personal relationship of mine. And I thought, well, wait a second, I don't hate her. what do you mean? And you know, the fact that, you know, I put it on the page that way was actually a very effective form of therapy for me, because, you know, having somebody else reflect that back, you know, allowed me to say, well, yeah, wait a second, there's obviously more stuff going on here than I thought.
Right, and maybe that was a place where you wanted to not leave it in the book.
Right. Yes, exactly.
Right.
Exactly.
You've written a number of books, and but this one I think is different from other things you've done.
Completely.
Yeah. So is this like a one-shot deal? Are you going to, you know, write like this again, or is this?
I think I will only write like this again. And certainly in terms of fiction. Obviously when I'm writing nonfiction, it's topic driven, but I think, you know, what I found is that I'm much more comfortable with the canvas that you have when you allow yourself to use elements of fantasy in the work, and sort of see this as, you know, as my place. You know, I think there was the first two novels were relationship based. One was a father son story, and the other a story about two best friends, and they were, you know, and they were much smaller stories, and I think there's a certain scope that you gain access to when you start using the fantastic, as long as you continue to to focus on the characters,
right?
And I just find that's what I really want to do. So I think all of my future work will have some element of fantasy in it, but will all be directed toward illuminating characters.
And so, do you stay then? Does it help to be writing a story that's grounded in the physicality and the relationships that you're very familiar with? Because that obviously comes through. You know, the book is set in Connecticut. You live in Connecticut. It's obviously it's meant to be a place that's familiar,
mm-hmm.
and one that you can write about comfortably, and at the same time launching into this imagined universe, with all these made up animals and made up colors and, you know, kind of very coming from the totally not realistic. So you kind of combine the two.
Well, yeah, and I think that probably will be the way I always work. I mean, you know, probably the writer in this area, the writer that influenced me the most is Ray Bradbury, and I always thought that Bradbury did an amazing job of placing you in the middle of, you know, a small, you know, Illinois town, and then, you know, transporting you into a magical realm. And he did it for the reason that I'm trying to do it, which is that by creating a truly grounded world, and then shifting from that, you get to reflect on our reality in a completely different way.
Right, and I think you succeeded in that. I think the book is very comfortable. It's fluid, and you move smoothly in both in and between the different realities, the normal everyday, and of course there's tension about the entry of other people into the fantasy world, you know, particularly Becky's mother not happy with this, and what you're there doing is kind of playing through the psychological issues of engagement, and, you know, almost it's almost like a therapeutic model.
Well, yeah. I mean, what I really want to do there. I mean, at the core of that dysfunctional relationship between between Chris and Polly was a really fundamental difference in the way they looked at the world. That Chris, for all of his inability to engage in his own life, saw life as a very possible place, and Polly was very pragmatic and always saw life in a pragmatic fashion. And things really started to break down for them when Becky got sick the first time, because Chris refused to believe that Becky wasn't going to get better, and Polly, saw it as a different kind of crisis. And what I was playing with there, of course, is that not just the notion that relationships that have fundamentally different values very rarely succeed, but also that embracing imagination is an essential need, I think. One of the things that we absolutely have to have in our lives, and that people who don't do that miss out on things. And there is a very significant moment toward the end of the novel that I won't go into detail about, but it becomes clear that Polly does miss out on something very, very critical that she could have embraced if she'd just been more open to using her imagination.
Right, and you could even use that argument, or that, not necessarily that argument, but that distinction to apply to people who aren't able to, participate in the spiritual or even the psychological worlds, that they're stuck in the rational and unable to engage in the emotional or the spiritual or the artistic. It's like, that distinction is really powerful.
Yeah, and that's certainly one of the themes that I'm working with here. This novel is not it's not overtly spiritual, but there are definitely spiritual components in this novel, and certainly one way to interpret it is extremely spiritual. But I'll leave that to the reader to decide.
I think that's best to do, in fact.
Yeah, especially on that topic, and it sort of reflects my own ambiguity about it.
Right. Well, yeah, I think there's no preaching here, so I think that's important too. It's you can read it any way you want to. It's an entertaining novel or an engaging novel, or it's one with more depth to it than maybe some other novels would be, but readers don't have to. They can engage in it wherever they feel most comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's really good. Well, it was a great book. I really enjoyed reading it, and it was fun, but it was also the magicality, or the feeling of being engaged into another place was really enjoyable, and I like the ambiguity, which I don't want to talk about too much more, but the ambiguity between deciding with in how you accept what happens in the book, whether mm-hmm. you want to take it as psychological or real magic, it's up to you. But I like that not being able to necessarily figure it out.
Yeah, no, all of that was very important to me, as was the whole construct of the fantasy world to begin with.
Well, obviously you had a lot of fun with that, and it's a pretty richly imagined other place.
It turned out to be a huge challenge because this is a world that was created between a guy and his 5-year-old daughter, but I didn't want it to be a world that a 5-year-old would have created, because
right.
That's too Disneyfied for me. the tool that I used, two tricks there. One is that the world kept evolving as Becky got older, so it was really sort of left off when she was 10, and I even mentioned at some point that she sort of reboots the world at some point, so that she takes out a lot of the really cutesy stuff that she had in it when she was little. But then the other technique that I used to sort of make the world as rich as I could was that at the point where she stops telling stories, the world goes off on its own and evolves on its own. And so, you know, at that point, it's not the product of a 10-year-old's imagination anymore. It's a world that evolves.
Right, and in fact, that was, I think that made it interesting, because then she has to learn about that world, because it's not all her creation.
Right.
It's something that when she comes to it at 14 is a whole new place. And, you know, she remembers some of the things, some of the elements of it from when she was younger and imagined it and told those stories. But as you said, you know, there's a whole bunch of stuff that she never thought of that just actually turns out to be there, which is kind of cool.
Yeah, and even that's, you know, relatively ambiguous, because it could just be stuff that was working in the back of her brain, or it could be that the world was
right.
actually evolving.
Right, you don't know. But, you know, that I like thinking about, you know, that there, you know, this is another way of imagining these alternate universes and different planes of reality, and they can be real, or maybe everyone, maybe even we are figments of our own imagination.
Exactly.
So that possibility exists just as well. So, you know, I like, you know, that it creates those enough ambiguity that you have to really think about it. So I think it's a book I would recommend.
Thank you.
Well, thanks, Lou. It's been great talking to you. This has been David Wilk for Writer's Cast. I've been talking to Lou Aronica, whose new book is called Blue. Thanks, Lou.
Thanks. Take care, David.